I'm not going to ask you to raise your hand, but look down and see if you have your name tag on. There are lots of name tags didn't get picked up. Let's remind one another to put our name tags on. We have new folks, visitors that are visiting every week, and it is just a kindness on our part to put our name tag on. So just a little reminder, and there'll be times when I'll forget and you can remind me, so let's just continue to remind each other to pick up our name tags. Today is the first in a series of lessons. I like series. That I'm going to entitle The Anatomy of Faith. And I'm still, there's something here in South Texas that still got me down. I'm taking antibiotics and steroids, and I don't know what all else, something in an inhaler that I don't know what is, but anyway, it's getting a little bit better slowly, but like some of you, whatever this is, it's hung on for a long time, so we're still operating at partial strength here today. I want you to be turning to Hebrews chapter 11. I'm going to ask for a little bit of indulgence on your part, because this lesson is going to be laying some foundation for lessons to come. I really do feel like that for some of us, this series of lessons may be the most important series of lessons that you've ever heard in your life, because my responsibility to you is to help you grow your faith. And that's what I'm about in my life, and it's what I want to accomplish. As Paul said in Romans chapter 1, I'm debtor, and I am a debtor to you. You brought me here for a purpose. And one of the primary things that I want to accomplish in my life with the people with whom I work and labor is that I want us to help each other grow our faith. And that's what this is all about. Just some foundational material again. One of the things that hinders us in our understanding of the Bible sometimes is we grow up with a definition of a word, and we take that one definition of that word to every situation, and sometimes it doesn't fit. So I'm going to just real quickly tell you that there are three ways that the Bible uses, the New Testament uses the term faith. Three different ways. And that one thing, if we would understand that and maybe make a little note to yourself about this, is going to help you as you study your Bible. One way that we've used very commonly in the past, or at least in my past, is illustrated in Jude verse 3. And it says that we are to earnestly contend for the faith once for all delivered or entrusted to the saints. And so one of the ways that the Bible uses the term faith is a body of knowledge. And we've used that very commonly in the past. That's not going to, however, be the primary focus of this study. But note to yourself that that's one of the ways, and it's a legitimate way that the Bible uses the term faith. It talks about a body of knowledge that has been once for all delivered and entrusted to the saints. And we are to contend for that faith. And then there are two others ways that the Bible uses the term faith, and one is a functional definition. A functional definition. And you find an illustration of it in Romans chapter 5, verse 2. It says, through Jesus Christ, we have gained access by faith into this grace wherein we now stand. If we were in a Bible class, we'd spend a lot more time on this right here. And we will spend more time in this series of lessons. Romans chapter 5, verse 2 says that faith is our avenue to access God's grace. That's one of the ways that the Bible uses the term faith. It's the way that we access people who have faith. God's saving grace is available to everyone. The way that we access that is through faith. That's what Romans 5:2 says. And then the third way that the Bible uses, New Testament uses the term faith, is illustrated in Hebrews chapter 11, verse 1, and it is what I would call a doctrinal definition. Faith is being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not see. The King James Version would say it is the substance of things hoped for and the evidence of things unseen. And so that is a doctrinal definition. One of them, and we're going to focus primarily on these last two. One of them is what faith is. That would be Hebrews chapter 11, verse 1. The other one is what faith does or accomplishes. It accesses God's grace for us. And so as we examine, first of all, this doctrinal definition, we're going to be looking at Hebrews chapter 11, verse 1 to begin. Let's see what we can learn about faith. So as you have your Bibles open there, one of the most familiar passages in the whole New Testament is Hebrews 11, 1. Faith is being sure of what we hope for, certain of what we do not see. This is what the ancients were commended for. The first thing that I want to note about faith is faith always has an objective. It always has a goal out there. And there are two characteristics about this goal. It says that this goal that our faith is stretching toward is something that we hope for and is something that we do not see. In other words, it's something that we don't have in our hand. It's something that is out there in the future. Everything that involves something that you can see or touch or feel or taste or smell, everything that involves things you can see, and that's most of the things that we deal with in this world, do not require faith for you to understand that they exist or how they function. If you can see it, you can put it in a test tube or you can analyze it, then it doesn't require faith for you to accept the conclusions that are drawn from that. Therefore, since that's primarily what we deal with in our life, there are lots of folks who have a very poor estimation of faith. People quite often in the world talk about faith in condescending terms. And that's the thought that I want to address this morning. It's whether or not that's a legitimate thing to do. What are some objectives of faith? What are some things that we hope for? What are some things that we do not see that our faith motivates us toward? Well, the writer gives us some examples here. So let's look at his examples first, and then in future studies we'll look at some other things. In verse 3, he gives us a really interesting one talking about faith. By faith, we understand that the universe was formed at God's command, so that what is seen was not made out of what was visible. That's an illustration of faith and conclusions that we draw by faith. Strangely, man has always sought to understand the universe, including life and how it all began. And we're really, really involved in that today. I mean, we're spending billions and billions of dollars today in pursuit of that very thing. Sometimes we may not even understand. There's some things that are happening, even like in space exploration and so forth, that we may not connect directly to it, but it is directly connected to our desire to know how all this thing began. Strangely, science has staked its claim in this area and said, this is our area here. When in fact, I'm going to question whether or not that really is science's area. Scientists work with energy and matter. And scientists generally are reluctant to accept what cannot be measured or analyzed in some way by experimentation. And we continue to search the universe for a rational explanation of how all this began and how life began. But science is never going to find that because it is out of its realm. But it has become such a common thing in our day that we think that science very well may find that source of life. Well, if it does, it's going to have to do so by methods other than what it's used up to this point. Because the universe, verse 3, was created, the things that are seen were created from things that did not exist, things that were not visible. The Hebrew in Genesis chapter 1 has a word for that, the word bara, God created. It means to create from nothing. It did not exist. God spoke it into existence by the power of His word. While science, we owe a debt, an incredible debt of gratitude. I mean, I started out by saying I'm taking antibiotics and I'm taking steroids and so forth. I can thank science for that, for helping me get over this stuff. And I have a deep respect and appreciation for science. But science is out of its field to answer the questions that it seeks through space exploration, fossil records. It has come up with, in these avenues and others, with things, theories, like the black hole, the Big Bang, the expanding universe, evolution, trying to find missing link to connect things together. Even the nuclear collider, they began, our dollars were spent on it, to construct one here in Texas a few years ago, and then abandoned it part of the way through after millions and millions and millions of dollars were spent on it. And the purpose of that is to get atoms sped up so quick, so fast, and moving so fast, and then run them together and explode them so that we can see the energy and evaluate the energy that is released, and hopefully that will give us a clue to how the universe began. That's what all this is about. At least that's a primary function of it. Science has discovered some incredible things, but it will never solve the mystery of the universe because it's a matter of faith. And when we say that, then we have a tendency to say that real quietly because the world accuses faith of being something that's blind. And we're going to address that in just a few moments. Look at verse 4. We're still talking about some examples of things we hope for, things we do not see. Let's quickly go through some of these illustrations that the writer has here. In verse 4, Abel's objective was to please God with his sacrifice. He was trying to accomplish something for the welfare of his future, for something he could not see. Verse 5 and 6, Enoch's objective was to be delivered from coming judgment. In fact, we don't have a lot about Enoch in the Bible, but Jude 14 and 15 says of Enoch that he saw impending judgment coming, and he was trying to avoid that. He says, Enoch, the seventh from Adam, prophesied about these men. And the whole epistle of Jude starts out talking about these men that have infiltrated your ranks as Christians, and it gives lots of characteristics about them, and they're not good characteristics. He said, even the seventh from Adam, Enoch, prophesied about this man. And here's what he said. See, the Lord is coming with thousands upon thousands of his holy ones to judge everyone, to convict all the ungodly of all their ungodly acts they have done in their ungodly way, and of all the harsh words ungodly sinners have spoken against him. And so he's saying Enoch saw this impending judgment, and his purpose, what he was looking for in the future, was he wanted to avoid that judgment. Verse 7, Noah's objective, look at it, was to save his family. And then verse 8 through 19, it picks up the story of Abraham. And in that context, there were a number of things that Abraham was looking for in the future. In verse 10, he was looking for a home that was built by God. In verse 12, he was looking for the fulfillment of that great nation that God was going to make of his descendants a great nation, that promise. In verse 17 through 19, he was looking for the fulfillment of that seed promise through his son Isaac. God had promised that certain things are going to happen and said it's going to be through this boy, Isaac, that those things are going to happen. And then God told him to go kill him. And it will say that as he looked, as Abraham looked into the future, and as he recognized and contemplated those promises that God gave to him and said, this boy is going to be the one through whom I'm going to fulfill it. And then he told him to go kill him. He says, Abraham reasoned into the future and he said, if I kill this boy, there's only one possible way. I know that God's faithful and God's righteous and God cannot lie. God's going to raise this boy from the dead if I kill him. And so he was ready to offer that boy's life with his conviction that God was going to raise him from the dead if he killed him. And then in verse 20, it's still talking about people who were looking to the future. Isaac had faith regarding the future of his sons, Jacob and Esau, and he blessed them in perspective of that future. Verse 22, Joseph hoped for the exodus of his descendants out of Egypt, and he was so confident about God coming and visiting his descendants and bringing them out of Egypt that he said, don't bury my body. Make me a mummy, because they certainly knew how to do that in Egypt, and then carry my bones up with you from this place when God comes in about 400 years and visits you. And so everything here in chapter 11 is talking about all of these people who were looking to the future. And by faith, they did certain things right now with a firm conviction that God was going to live up to his promises in the future. And so they based their life right now on that future. So faith always has a future goal, an objective, something unseen, something hoped for. And their attitude, the second thing I want to note is, what was their attitude in regard to what they hoped for? Well, it says in verse 1, they were sure of it, and they were certain of it. And this is where I want to be in my life. And this is where I want you to be. And this is what we're working toward. So that you can live with an absolute confidence that what God has said to you and the promises that are in the Bible, that you can live with absolute confidence. So that when really difficult times come into your life, it's not going to knock your feet out from under you. You're going to keep your eyes on that goal. The Hebrew writer uses a word that means the assurance or the substance. And that word means things that underlie something else, or something that stands under something else. Our faith stands under everything in our life. And that's what we're looking for here. Just as Jesus makes us certain of God's existence, we know that there is a God. One of the reasons that we know there's a God is because of his son Jesus. Faith, with its evidence that accompanies it, makes us absolutely certain that God's word is true and his promises are true. And even though we can't see him, God is real. And Jesus Christ is one evidence that God is real. You see, men of faith know for certain that God's real. And we say it. But I want us, and you want to be, and I want to be, in a position so that my life is completely about one thing. I know that God is real. I know that his promises are true. And I build everything in my life on that knowledge, that faith. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 6 says, in order for you to have faith, in order for you to be absolutely sure that you know that God is real and that you have every right to all of those promises and that you build your life on it, in order to have the kind of faith that God wants you to have, verse 6 says you've got to know two things. Number one, that he exists. And you can't just acknowledge that because your mama told you it was true. You have to know that for yourself, that God exists, and number two, that he rewards those who diligently seek him. You've got to know those two things. And we're going to be working in the next few weeks on helping ourselves know that. Now, I have a question for this morning. Is faith an inferior way of knowing something? And I'm going to use this to spring into lessons, and we're going to come back and refer to this. Is faith an inferior way of knowing something? The world, by and large, would say yes. Faith is not a very good way of knowing something. John, the inspired writer, says no. John chapter 20, verse 30 and 31, it's not an inferior, by no, I mean it's not an inferior way of knowing something. John 20, 30 and 31, you're familiar with the passage. Jesus truly did many other things that are not written in this book, but these are written that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and by believing, what? You might have life through his name. Miracles prove that Jesus is God's Son. He didn't come to heal the world. He came to show you God. And so that you would have every reason to know that God exists. God never asks you to believe something without supplying adequate evidence. I'm going to repeat that phrase for the next 6 weeks, several times. God never asks you to believe anything that he doesn't give you adequate evidence to believe. Psalm 19:1, the heavens declare the glory of God and the skies proclaim the work of his hands. Every time you go outside, God's preaching a lesson to you. What's he saying? I exist. I exist. I want you to know that. As you look up into the heavens, as you see what's happening this spring, as you see the waters that give life, as you see all of these things, I want you to know something. I exist. Romans 1:20, for since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood from what? What's been made. As you look out there, you can know certain things about God. You can know he's divine, he's more than a man, and he has powers that far exceed anybody I've ever known or that you've ever known. He says, so that men are without excuse. Or without excuse for what? To know that there's a God. The fool has said in his heart, there's no God. Why is that true? Because nature shouts, there is a supreme being somewhere, right? There is a God who's more powerful than man is somewhere. And yet we know that God exists and Jesus Christ is his son by faith. You've never seen God. And I've never seen God. These eyes can't see spirit. And God is spirit. And so we look at all of this evidence and we draw a conclusion. Is that conclusion by faith an inferior way of knowing something? If you have all of this evidence in front of you, then faith is not an inferior way of knowing something. Not if it has adequate evidence. You see, I get tired of seeing Christians retreat because somebody says, you Christians accept things by blind faith. I don't accept things by blind faith. My faith is not blind. My faith is based on solid evidence. And I maintain, and I will discuss with, be happy to discuss with you, that my reasons for believing that there is a God is much more reasonable and logical and has more evidence than your conclusion there is no God. My faith is not blind. Do you have to see to believe? Well, Thomas did, didn't he? I mean, they came to him and said, we've seen the resurrected Lord, and he said, right. I'll believe, John chapter 20, verse 25, when I see the nail marks in his hands, I put my finger where the nails were and put my hand in his side, and until then I won't believe it. A week later, same context, Jesus appeared to his disciples, and this time Thomas was present. And the first thing the Lord did, before he did anything else, verse 27 of John 20, he walked over to Thomas and he said, put your finger here, look at my hands, reach out your hand and put it in my side, and stop doubting. the very three things that Thomas said he was going to have to see in order to believe, God provided for him. And he will say, my Lord and my God. And Jesus will respond by saying, because you've seen me, you have believed. Blessed are they who have not seen and yet have believed. That's you and that's me. That's who he's talking about. And in the very next verse, he said, Jesus truly did many other things that are not written in this book. But these are written that you who have not seen, you who have not touched that hole, you who have not put your hand in my side, these things are written that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and believing you might have life through his name. God has supplied more than adequate evidence for our faith. Now you need to know this up front. There will always be some who will not believe. There always have been, and there always will be. And they have their reasons for not wanting to believe in many cases, regardless of how much evidence there is. And I want to say to you that sometimes some of those people who don't believe are pretty close to you. And they may have a strong influence in your life. And I want to say to you, you have to make faith your own. You can't inherit a faith and ride that all the way to the end of your life. We start out by an inherited faith, whatever we've been taught. We all have to start there. But God has put all of this evidence in front of us, and he has every right to expect us to come to the conclusion that God exists. There will be some who are like the Pharisees in Matthew chapter 16. The Pharisees and Sadducees came to Jesus, tested him by saying, we want to see a sign from heaven. And the implication was that all of these miracles that he had been doing weren't from heaven. We want to see a sign from heaven, they said. And Jesus said, you're able to look at the sky and tell what the weather's going to be. And then he gave some illustrations about that. And then he said, but you are a wicked and adulterous generation that looks for this miraculous sign, and you're not going to get any more signs except one more. What was it? The sign of the prophet Jonah. And that represented what? The resurrection. There's going to be one more sign for you. And Romans chapter 1 verse 3 says that is the ultimate proof that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. And whenever he had said that to them, you're only going to get one more sign. It says Jesus forsook them and went away. He walked out of the room and he turned the light off. And they will live in darkness until they die. God has given us an incredible amount of evidence to know that he exists. And we're looking at the anatomy of faith, and we're going to talk about what it is and how we get it and how it affects us. It's our avenue for receiving salvation. Without faith, it's impossible to please God. He's going to say later in this chapter that we're looking at. And with absolute certainty in God and in his word, we must realize that this doesn't come overnight. It's something that we grow inch by inch by inch. By understanding what God has to say, by looking at the evidence and putting it into practice in our life to see if it works. In order to grow our faith, we have to know what to focus on. And we're going to start out by focusing on, does God exist? Do you know that? I know that you say, yes, I do. I'm asking you, do you know that without any doubt? You've got to know that. That's got to be the foundation. And you have to know that God is really faithful and he's going to do what he said. He's provided more than adequate evidence for you to be sure and to be certain. And if you believe that God exists, do you believe that Jesus Christ is his son? If you do, you're on the road. Because Jesus Christ came to give his life a ransom for many. He came to give you the promises from God. And the primary promise that he came to give you is that if you live and believe in me, you'll never die. I'll bring you home. And he told his disciples as he was about to leave, don't be afraid. In my Father's house are many rooms, and I go and prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I'll be back to get you, so that where I am, there you may be also. He's coming back one day. That is an absolute certainty. He's coming back one day. Are you ready for him to come back while we stand and sing?
We have just a few announcements that we need to make. Things that weren't included in the bulletin, please get a bulletin and read the material that's there. It's important. First of all, we want to welcome our visitors. And we're pleased that you're here today. And please meet some of us after this is over. And we will have a Bible school at 9:30. And there's plenty of time to visit, get you a cup of coffee and a donut, and talk to people. We have two new members to introduce, three actually, two families. Carol Ruthloff, is she here this morning? She probably will attend second service, but please meet her. She's asked to be a member of this congregation. And Billy and Liz Coleman, are they here? They're coming to second service too, I think. But they'll probably be here before Bible class or afterwards, and so meet them if you get a chance. The Colemans are from Magnolia. This announcement, which was too late to be in the bulletin, Kay Doughty's great aunt passed away this week, and she's gone to North Texas to be with her mother and the family there, and please keep her. I do not know the aunt's name. She was about 100 years old, incidentally, and had a very long life. Hermina Lawler, Jill Bradley's mother, had three stents inserted into her heart arteries and is doing very, very well, and they expect her to recover completely now. And please keep them in your prayers as well. There are books in the foyer on the round table that are free for you to take and give to somebody. You'll have a chance to purchase books for yourself next week, but for now, take these free books and give them to a friend, a neighbor, someone you know, to let them learn about Jesus and his life and teachings. Thank you very much.
Let's stand and sing the closing song.